Today's episode of The Occasional Podcast is brought to you by The Occasional Magazine. Check out the downloadable quarterly magazine that focuses on the nexus of high fidelity and lifestyle. The winter edition will become available for download next Saturday, February 3rd. The Occasional Magazine is packed with great reviews and imagery, and this latest issue even includes shots from our interview here with Zev Feldman. To grab your copy, visit parttimeaudiophile.com. You can find a link to the landing page for the magazine right at the top in the navigation bar. Welcome. It is episode 5 of The Occasional Podcast.
Dun, dun, dun.
Today's interview is Zev Feldman.
All right.
And here today with me is my co-host Brian Beasley.
Hello, the occasional co-host for the occasional podcast.
Photographer, director, and vinyl enthusiast. Appropriate co-host for Zev, who is the Indiana Jones of vinyl.
Ooh.
But is he essentially, instead of grabbing things that belong in a museum, he takes them and he reissues them. So he goes out and he searches for lost jazz records.
That's awesome.
It's like his mission statement. One of the companies he worked for is actually a nonprofit.
Okay.
This thing is all about the love. So he basically goes to these giant record jazz meetings, tries basically to find the families of people. And then he asks, as you'll hear in the interview, I'm not going to ruin the line, but sure. He has a thing. He goes around and he asks people.
I think that's awesome.
It's pretty admirable. If you're a jazz fan, I mean, this guy is like doing the Lord's work.
That's the best part about vinyl, if you ask me, is because you can go to these record shops and you can find music that isn't, I mean, I guess they don't make DVDs or CDs anymore. You can't find it online. So some of this stuff, like these deep tracks on some of these like really awesome 70s and 60s albums, the only way to listen to it is on vinyl. So plus I just love there's a vintage nostalgia feel to it for me when I pop them on.
It's definitely like a process, right? You sit down, you enjoy it. The artwork.
Yeah.
I talk about this in the interview too.
You're not clicking a button and just shuffling a playlist. They're actually, you have to make a conscious effort that you're going to listen to these 6 or 7 songs, however many songs is on one side. And, there's the mechanics of the record player too is like, it's very simple. It's just a few moving parts, and I don't know. I love it.
I always found it like kind of crazy that like a needle touching a groove, produces sound somehow,
and that it produces every sound.
Yeah, I was talking to some producer or something. Said you got to be careful with like major shifts from loud to soft, because if you do like a really deep groove, to a really shallow one, it can literally flick the needle out of the groove.
Huh.
I'm not too technical here, and I bet you there's 1,000 listeners right now saying, that guy is f***ing wrong.
I'm sure.
But that's what I was told.
Yeah, well, luckily there'll be a comment section for those people to set you straight.
But I like it. I like the conversation, guys. And by the way, I didn't mention this before, but if you do have any comments, questions, anecdotes you'd like to share,
Keep them to yourself.
No, that's not true. Please talk to me. I'm here to listen. And the email address is theoccasionalpodcast@gmail.com. How easy is that, Bees?
That's pretty easy. I can remember it. And you've got it written down for me.
I think I've heard some of the most amazing sound come ever from a record.
Okay.
I've heard it from other places, but a lot of times I hear magic. Magic, like magic fairies in my ears, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also like the process. Because you got to freaking focus on it. You have to you literally have to focus on putting a tiny needle on a record. And so it makes the whole experience about the music. So here's our interview with Zev Feldman. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Have a great week.
amazing what we can do now. I mean, making it so portable. Look what you just did here. Unbelievable. Wow.
Yeah, so for everybody just tuning in, we are at Zev's house in Los Angeles, and we have set up a portable podcast studio to get things fired up and going. So welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your schedule. I know you're a very busy man. So
sure. It's great to be with you, Brian. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's great to spend some time with you today.
The general population doesn't just fall directly into jazz. Who or what got you interested in this genre in specific that you've done so much for?
I would say a lot of my love for jazz was nurtured by my own family, especially my father. You know, I would say openly that, you know, when I was growing up, I was really into a lot of rock and R&B and all sorts of music, especially what they were playing on pop radio in the early 80s, which was a culmination of everything from the Rolling Stones to Paul McCartney solo to Stevie Wonder. I mean, it was the middle of the road, but it was the top 40 of the day. So I think my father was a big part of it. I have memories of him will be in the car, and I wanted to hear the pop station, and my dad wanted to play the public jazz station, and he made it his point to play that for me. I remember being around my father. We'd be washing the car when we were kids, and I remember one time, you know, Cannonball Adderley and Nancy Wilson came on the radio, and my father would tell me, oh, he knew the songs. He wanted to talk to me about this history. But Brian, jazz music is actually in my DNA, and he was trying to connect me with that, I think. And what I mean by that is we have many, many musicians that are in my family. If I had to tell you about a couple of the more well-known, first of all, I have a great uncle. I had a great uncle. I unfortunately never knew him in my lifetime. His name was Alvin Abe Aaron, and he was literally the first entry of the, I think it's the 1962 or 63 Encyclopedia of Jazz by Leonard Feather. And to have someone in my family who is my grandmother's brother in that book, I tell you, I felt like, you know, wow, that's really cool. And my Uncle Abe's brother, Joe Aaron, was a musician and an educator in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for over 50 years, actually probably even longer than that. Pardon me, I'm speaking out of turn here. And my cousin Rick Aaron, who is a jazz and classical flautist in Milwaukee. I have cousins that play in symphony, you know, or symphony musicians that have gone to institutions such as Oberlin and have studied music. My cousin Raphael Kianowski, who is unfortunately no longer around, he was a musicologist himself who studied music at University of Wisconsin, and he taught gentlemen like Brian Lynch, the trumpet player. You could talk to him. He'll tell you about my cousin Raffy. And, you know, music, though, is around us. But growing up in my home, you know, it's interesting. I'd say that the Beatles were a big part of my diet growing up. And, you know, my mom and dad had three Beatles records, the White Album, Abbey Road, and Hey Jude, and I used to play those to death. And then my father would try to play Jimmy Smith, and he would try to play other music. And my mom, you know, we had all these RCA Living Stereo recordings on vinyl when I was a kid. So I remember hearing that at home. And also, I would be with my mother in the car, and she would play the classical station. Music is a big part of my DNA. It's what I was surrounded with growing up. And it festered into a self-discovery. I felt for many years, especially in my teenage years, I could tell you every day in high school, I would, you know, instead of sitting around the cafeteria, I'd be in the library, I'd be reading record review guides and trying to check out which are the records that I'm going to spend my money on. And so, like, you know, for me, I think a lot of time was spent researching and then going after certain records. It's interesting. I don't know how it is for everyone else, but I knew that when I was in high school, money was a premium. I had this job at a gas station. I used to clean up after mechanics. I worked at Burger King. You know, I worked a graveyard shift at a gas station while I was in school. Like, this was, you know, I'll tell you, man.
And was all that, like, you wanted to spend the money on records?
All the time. All I wanted to do was take that income, and I would drop it on music and CDs. And I remember my grandfather would be like, "You're spending too much on CDs." And then one day, he said that line when an older cousin was in the room. "CDs, that's a good thing. Certificate of deposit, right?" No. He is buying compact discs. Come on. My grandfather, George Georges, who was this amazing, boisterous, really tough guy, you know, everywhere I looked in my childhood, music was around the corner in some way, shape, or form. I would try to find, you know, these pieces of it. I remember being at my grandmother's home in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I would visit sometimes, at least a couple times a year. And, you know, looking through her record collection, my Bubby and Zeta, as we say, were into everything, including opera. I mean, that's how I got turned on to Pavarotti years before I would eventually go off to work for and represent artists and labels such as Deutsche Grammophon, Philips, Decca, Verve. You know, I've just been really blessed, but it's everywhere around me, man. And when I didn't work in the music business, I wanted to do everything I could to escape to listening to music. Mm. And it's been very, very therapeutic for me in my life. I've spent, I won't lie though, I've spent a lot of time alone in my life. And when I was younger, especially, really, you know, I didn't go to my high school prom. I didn't have a date. I stayed home and I listened to Miles Davis. He became my friend in the music amongst the whole cast of incredible musicians that inspired me. And I found this escape and something that really took over. And it's incredible. And all these years later, to be doing this work that I'm doing now, I'm just every day I wake up just feeling blessed and fortunate and grateful. I really am grateful. Brian, I say this over and over again, but I have this expression. It's really simple. I just don't want to break anything.
Yeah.
I just want to be able to keep sustaining and doing what I'm doing. So anyways.
In a way, what you're doing now in your mind, is that like a thank you to these artists by helping bring these things out and saving, preserving those ideas? Is that like a thank you to them, even though many of them aren't alive anymore, but at least you're contributing to the legacy of these.
Wow, it's nice to think of it that way. I'd say first and foremost, it's about chasing a hobby. Imagine just having your biggest passion, your interest, and it involves your job. How lucky am I? I think of this situation a lot because I could be in a convenience store or in a car or traveling somewhere, and I meet people all the time that just have a job. But my job has a different role. And it didn't always start this way. But, you know, when I take on the to answer your question, Brian, to take on the project itself, I feel absolutely there is such a high level of responsibility. And you know what? I always want to make it as exciting and as big as it can be and interesting. Let's have all the voices. I want to give you an example. You know, when I first started working with really one of the first artists in the States, families I worked with, was Wes Montgomery's family. And Wes, to me, was this larger-than-life guy because his music was played in my house growing up. And when I was a little boy, my father would pick me up from summer camp. And I remember in the evenings, Gwen Redding, the radio host at WDCU in Washington, she had this program called Caravan. It was the public jazz station there, and every day they would open up with Wes Montgomery playing his version of Caravan from Moving West, and that big sound and hearing that thumb. And that was like, man, I guess I've been listening to his chord playing for, you know, his octaves for a very long time. So, you know, this stuff kind of comes full circle, but when I am working with a family and it's someone, hey, when we take on these projects, they happen because I'm passionate about them and I believe in them. And I'm leading a team and I have the trust of that family member or that family, and I don't want to let them down. And you know what? For all of us, for the family, for preserving the legacy, But it gets bigger than that. I'm doing it for all of us. I'm kind of doing it for me selfishly, too. I'm having fun over here. Yeah. But, you know, it's not boring. But we say to ourselves, what can we do here? Because you know what? We're in this different time now, this different landscape. And curating is different. Huh? It's about the day of the playlist now. Yeah. I still like to think about it's the day of the album. And, you know, to get a chance to work on these projects, especially putting together the written materials. Mm. That is something that we do here. And thanks to George Klabin. He is the man that gave me my start, basically producing records, because I've been working in the music business since 1993. But he allowed me to do this and to connect that. So when we do these projects, thanks to George, we're, you know, we make it as great as it can be. And it means really exhausting that, first of all, having your thought dump of, what are we going to do in this booklet? We're going to tell the story. Who can we interview? Who was there? Who has an interesting perspective to share? And I think that we are doing more than just curating music at the Resonance label, but also really trying to create new written materials. If you read the Jaco Pastorius booklet, the CD was 90. It was a 100-page book. And Larry Young in Paris was a 72-page book. We had a 92-page book for Thad Jones, Mel Lewis, All My Yesterdays. You know what? We are doing this form of investigative journalism, I think. Mm-hmm. But we have a responsibility there. But you know what? It doesn't have to be that way. Most record labels, hey, let's get the music together in one essay. Let's call it a day. I say, no, no. If George is going to give us that chance, we're going to go all inside. And we're going to say, hey, you know, I think about, you know, it's like one of these, it's no different than a, you know, could be, I could be working for 60 minutes, or I've been putting together my piece, my expose. But that's what these are. These are like under the microscope. We're going to talk about this. We're going to listen to the music, but we're going to leave you with more than that. To do that in the age of playlists, I think really says something about this company. But listen, that's Resonance. But a lot of that stems from me. I could have done probably one or two essays, called it a day. George, can we do more? And now it has really become part of my MO, because it's not just Resonance. I'm doing this now for Elemental Music in Europe. I'm working with Corey Weeds of Cellar Live Records of Vancouver, Canada. And we are developing a historical wing of recordings that will come out on his label, Cellar Live. And we're using that same foundation and principles. Who are the voices that we need to have contribute? Not just slapping any group of people together, but who has something to say? And it's really proved to be an opportunity to go back. In the case of Larry Young in Paris, there had never been a book written on Larry Young. There wasn't an official bio. We set the record straight. We ended up working with the family to have a bio even put in for the first time. We make these discoveries, these things that come out sometimes when we're in the middle of making these projects. You know, I think a great example of that, you were asking me earlier, hey, there are any interesting stories? I'd say one of those lessons was when we were working on the Larry Young in Paris project, and we made this revelation about the inspiration of Larry Young and where that came from. Well, as we're doing this research and working with Larry Young III putting together this bio, oh, it just came to the surface that he had studied under a woman named Olga Van Til, who now, that was also Bill Evans's pianist, and she was a student of Stravinsky. As a result of this research, you know, we were able to make a connection of, hey, Larry Young's influences also came from Eastern Europe and these composers. And now we also have a better idea of Zoltan and all this music that Larry Young and Woody Shaw were listening to in that time. It was stemmed greatly in part because of these teachers that he was with and other things that were around. I mean, mind-blowing to me, you know, that we are able to sometimes, you know, make history and make these discoveries, and it becomes more of, hey, it's not just the record, but it's about the story to tell too. And that's the part that I hope people will also, you know what, I hope people will read those materials. We work our butts off really trying to do a great job. And I think when you learn so much when you read these supplemental materials. They're there for a reason. But when you put on the recording, please check out the written materials. You're missing the other half of the story if you're just listening to the music.
Finding and restoring and reintroducing lost works of art, you know, like this is on any level, kind of feels like something that is a calling for those involved. Did this opportunity that you do now present itself to you at a certain point, or is it something that you set out to do?
It came together. It's thanks to George Klaban at Resonance. He's the first guy. Now, there's nothing shocking here. I have been listening to jazz and collecting older, you know, jazz recordings for a long time. I mean, music from the 50s through 70s and jazz in particular is especially a big soft spot in my heart. And since I've worked in the music business, going back to my days of working at PolyGram, where we had Verve Records and Universal, even labels like ECM, I am interested. There's something about the older recordings in what we called catalog that speaks to me. I think back on the times when the promotional copies would come in when I worked in distribution, and I wanted those reissues. I loved the artwork. I loved reading. I loved the presentation, and there was something about that that really struck me. Now, as much as I love living artists too, please don't get me wrong, and I work with living artists all the time too, but on this subject in particular, it's important. So here's how it all started at Resonance, and it started there probably about 2009. I remember going to work for George, and he knew that I had a quote-unquote encyclopedic knowledge for jazz, whatever that really means. And but he's like, but Zev, you've never produced an album before? You know all this stuff about music. I said, yeah. He said, well, guess what? That's going to change for me. And I'll tell you what, Zev, I'll make you a deal. If you can find recordings that haven't been out before, I'm not really interested in reissues, Zev, but if you can find new recordings that haven't been out, and I like it, I'll tell you what, you can produce it for us. And that was all I needed to hear. It was like fire on gasoline. All of a sudden, I started expanding so much energy into trying to make phone calls to people. One guy I was driving crazy was George Klaban's old friend, Michael Cascuna, one of the most iconic and important record producers, musicologists, writers, journalists. He's done it all, minds of this music. And I think that a lot of your listeners out there would agree that he really helped establish a precedent and standard in this work that we do. And he's someone that I've always been really smitten, you know, inspired by. And he's one of my heroes in this music, and I'm very privileged to have had a chance to get to know him. But anyways, back in 2010, I started calling him. And it was a very interesting connection was made. George Klaban of Resonance, back in the 1960s, was the DJ and head programming guy for jazz music at WKCR-FM in New York City. And Michael Cascuna, who I believe was a high school student at the time, used to call into George's radio program all the time and would win the contest probably for albums and concert tickets. So those two cats knew each other. So then all of a sudden, a new day, I'm calling Michael on behalf of Resonance, on behalf of George Klaban, his old friend. It was really cool. So I'd call Michael, you know of anything? And I would get an email or a phone call. Give this guy a call. I heard of something that might be over there for you. And one day the phone rang. It was him, and we spoke. And he explained to me that he had these recordings of Wes Montgomery that he had acquired some time back. I believe actually Bruce Lundvall had acquired them. And a decision needed to be made of what to do with them because they were just sitting with them and the original plan of putting them out wasn't coming to fruition. So, Zeb, would Resonance be interested? So George and I huddled. Absolutely. We heard this music. And it was the first full album of previously unissued West Montgomery material to come out since the Willow Weep For Me record from West Montgomery in 1968 after Wes had passed away, which, by the way, was just a lot of odds and ends. And it's a very cool album, actually. But, you know, it was like, oh, my gosh, we're going to be doing this major, major mission here, putting this all together to release that. So that was really like the beginning of the Jazz Detective. That was really, I made, all we had were tapes with these songs. We didn't know who was on them. We knew it was Wes. You knew it was Wes, but we didn't know. So I made three trips to Indianapolis where I met with musicians and local folks that were still alive at the time who sadly are no longer with us and others. And we did all this due diligence. And you know, it was Dr. David Baker, the late, great Dr. David Baker of Indiana State University at Bloomington, who sat with me in his office in his home, and we listened, and he said, Zev, do you hear the way that that bass line was just played? I said, sure. He said, there's only one guy that plays like that. And you know, Zev, I know that that's not an electric bass. That's acoustic, but that's Monk Montgomery. I have no questions about it. Zev, do you hear the way? And he would give me this clear methodology in between his reasoning why, and it was, and that was it. And there was other research that came out. We ended up connecting with the late Mingo Jones, the bassist on some of those records, and it just reaffirmed it. It was amazing. It took us a few trips. But, you know, that, I think, is an example of a record company committed. A lot of companies, and I can't fault them, you know, in this day and age, they're looking at, especially the larger ones, hey, what's coming out in the next quarter? We need to have our release schedule going. Now, Resonance is a 501c3 not-for-profit foundation. We are a registered nonprofit corporation in the state of California. Our mission is different. Our mission is about curating and preserving this music. You know, as George says to me time and time again, Zev, we are building a museum that is going to live on past our lifetime. And if you Google search and read the article in the New York Times from December of 2016, George also talks at length about how this really is a philanthropic effort. George is one of the most generous, selfless people that I've ever met, who doesn't have to be doing any of this, but he chooses that, you know, that was something important to him. Jazz music has played an important part in his life, and he wants for that to live on and for us to do these efforts. And we get along very well. We're both very passionate together, and I think that I've learned a lot from him, and he's given me opportunities, and my life is so much richer because of him, and it's really richer because of all the people that are listening now who go and buy these records. When you make those purchases, it allows us to sustain and our mission and what we're doing. I'm just grateful. I get emails from people from all over the world, and I'm just like, wow. They write to me, hey, I listened to that record, and I was really touched by it. I'm just like, isn't that incredible? How wonderful. I just don't want it to end. I just want us to keep going with what we're doing.
In those regards, do you have a favorite project or a best outcome that you are most proud of?
I think a record I'm really proud about, and it really speaks to and epitomizes the story of what we're doing, is the Bill Evans Some Other Time album, which was released in the spring of 2016. It's become the biggest selling album in our label's history. We've been around for 10 years. And as of right now, that's done over 50,000 copies worldwide. Hey, man, sometimes we sell a few thousand and it's a success. Mm. Our motivation isn't on what it sells. We build it. It's like that famous movie with, you know, Kevin Costner, Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. I really try to have that approach. But the assembling of that album and how it came together is really an interesting story. In 2014, I was at the Jazz Ahead Conference in Bremen, Germany, And it's a yearly convergence where record companies and journalists and artists and booking people and anyone you think, distributors, anybody you think about in the music business for jazz comes to this. And it's great. And I like it because I get to meet people from all over the world. And in 2014, I met the family from MPS Records in the Black Forest in Villingham, Germany. And I met the family and one of the chief engineers, and it was a very interesting experience. I think I was just personally excited because it's one of my favorite record labels, and I've collected it extensively. And I had a chance to meet with the family, and I have this question, Ryan, I ask people time and time again. So, do you have any tapes? And I remember this gentleman looking over both shoulders, seeing if anyone's around. He looks me straight in the eye, and he says to me, can you keep a secret? I said, sure, absolutely. He says, we have a studio album from Bill Evans that's never been released from 1968 with Eddie Gomez and Jack DeJohnette. And I think I nearly fainted when he told me this. And he took me out to his car in the parking lot of the Expo Center, and he proceeded to play me some of this music. And I was just floored. Are you kidding me? I mean, this is what it's about. You hope you're going to find something, but you have nothing until you have a contract. Mm-hmm. I had to get to know these people. They don't know me. Mm-hmm. And relationship building, getting to know them, and here's what we can do. And it took months to exchanging and expressing what we wanted to do, build a package that celebrated Bill Evans, but also told the family's perspective and what their history and connection was to all this. And we did that. And it took us about, you know, I think the following December, I fly to Hamburg and I met with the brother of the one of the brothers. I met with Andreas Brunner-Schwier, and we signed this contract. And okay, now I have the rights for their copyrights in terms of their permission to put it out. But I wasn't done yet. I needed to get the record label because Bill Evans was signed to an exclusive recording contract in 1968 to Verve Records. The way that it works here in this country, if an artist was under an exclusive recording contract at the time the recording was made, that record label has first right of refusal. Mm. And I went to Universal Music Group, who owns Verve now, and I met with representatives. I explained who we were, what we're trying to do. I'd actually been working with them, I believe, already a little bit at this point. So with their cooperation, we received their blessing, and we made an arrangement to put this out with their blessing, and an arrangement was made. And once I had that, then I went to, I met with the family, you know, Evan Evans, who at that point I'd already worked with on a deal, on another project, Bill Evans Live Atop the Gate, which were George Klabin's recordings from the Village Gate Jazz Club in 1968, also incredible recordings, which we unearthed as well. But I got all the musicians to come together, and then we go into production mode. Then we put it together, and, man, it just was amazing. Everything came together, but it was a new chapter. It rewrote the history books. It gave us more insight into what was happening in Bill Evans's life, career, where he was at that time, and especially of this one particular tour. So I think that that might be one of the most riveting experiences, but it was really a journey with a lot of highs and lows. Some days I didn't know if things were going to work themselves out. You know, when you do these projects, you know, it ain't over till it's over, like Yogi Berra. It ain't over till you get your contract from all your rights holders. Yeah. And it's a long road sometimes, but thankfully with George Klabin, he's allowed me to stay the course. It's not about, you know, billing, and it's about doing the best job we can. And I think we delivered that, and I think the fans speak to it. My gosh, if you're lucky enough to find one of the two LP sets, there were 4,000 of them made. And it clearly was enough because now they're selling on Discogs for just under $300, I've seen. If this was a record that listed at $50. Man, but that's what it's about.
Do you, so for those audiophiles who listen to the show, do you have a recommendation for a jazz album that sounds best? Is there a classic track that sounds better than the others? And maybe that was like ahead of its time production-wise?
Well, I'll give you some examples. And I think, you know what it boils down to? It depends on what your favorites are. I'll tell you, one of my favorite records, this was a record that hit me like a ton of bricks, was Miles Davis's Roundabout Midnight, produced by the great George Avakian, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Red Garland, Paul Chambers, Philly Joe Jones. And I'll tell you, when I heard the SACD of that album, you know, there's something you hear a record many times, and then sometimes you hear a different format. Certain things leap out. You know, another guy, not jazz, Bob Ludwig, when he did the Bob Dylan. I mean, I listen to a lot of different stuff, okay? But, you know, Bob Ludwig did these SACD hybrids of a big chunk of the Bob Dylan catalog. It came out in a nice box set many years ago of the individual albums, and they were able to make something happen. The Rolling Stones, I think, was it Ludwig did those two? But, man, there's something about it. Sometimes I think it starts with the recording that you love. But, you know, acoustics, I mean, was something recorded a certain way? I mean, let me think about that for a moment. You know, ECM pops in my head. I don't know, the way that Coln or some of those other recordings were made, Sun Bear, you know, I'm trying to think, my father would play those in the home. And I remember I would go visit my Uncle Jimmy in Chicago, who's still there, and he would have these electrostatic speakers that would drill into the ground. And I remember experiencing at a young age, these towers, these giant towers, they would go up to the ceiling almost. For me, like, I appreciate to this day, and I always have, good sound. Maybe I don't give myself enough credit for being an audiophile as I should, because I've experienced things, but you know, and headphones, what they matter to us. You know, for me, I remember being very young, I'm talking about 5-6 years old, and having my father's headphones. My gosh, what the heck were they? This was, listening in a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, we all develop our habits and what we like to do. Some of us want to give it the headphone listen. Some of it have a chair you want to sit at where you're positioned right in the center field. You know, it's cool. We all have our thing, but we are also connected in this via the music. It's definitely the fabric that runs between us.
In just being here in your dwelling, I can see that you have a vast collection of CD and vinyl. Do you feel that the analog recordings of vinyl bring anything additive to the sound over digital ones? Or to me, is it more about the individual production of each album? Does this format to you sound different than the digital?
It does. It's a different experience for me. You know, oftentimes the vinyl, you know, if it's a record that I really love, like, you know, I want to track down a first pressing. I want to be able to experience it the way that it was originally heard when it came out by the mass public. So, you know, I want to hear that record in the first pressing. And I'll tell you, I've been very lucky. George Klabin was a DJ at KCR, like I mentioned, and Francis Wolfe and Alfred Lyon gave him personally, you know, many of these first pressings. And I have a lot of them here in my home. And those are the ones that I go to. But on the other hand now, it's like if I want to hear In and Out from Joe Henderson, do I put on my original, you know, a stereo or mono, or do I put on the Music Matters version of it too? Holy cow. Man, you know, it's amazing what you can do and what you can achieve. But for me, it's like, you know, I like, if I have a favorite album, chances are I probably have a favorite recording. There's an LP of it if it came out from years ago. And it's it. You know, I listen to it in different ways. You know, I listen to it in earbuds sometimes when I'm at the gym. It's a little different versus, you know, we have different ways that we ingest this. But I really try to hold true to making it an experience. I despise just throwing on something if I really can't listen. When I'm at home doing things, sometimes it's a little better, but like at work, like when you're working and you got to pause things, there is something very ritualistic. That it's a whole experience for me. It's a very holy thing. We're lucky to be able to feel passion and excitement for something and to love something. You know, a lot of people, and sadly enough, haven't found that or won't find that in our lives, but that's been like a spark for me. I get a little obsessive about it, but, you know, you ask me, I have an opinion on it. I feel very blessed to feel something in the first place when you listen to a recording. It's just, you know, it transports me. It does things to me. I've had these experiences going back when I'm very young. Music does something to me. It's a part of my soul, man. I don't know how else to articulate it, any differently. So I
do think there's a lot to the experience. Coming where I was kind of, the way I was raised listening to music, unfortunately, I landed pretty much in the era of the cassette. And if you know, they're not even around really anymore, but if you are familiar with a cassette, the artwork is about as small as it gets. Sure. It had like this tiny little thing that folded out, you know, and it was like so just one flap, right? And to sit down and to do the things, like especially the time and energy that you've put into that experience of unfolding a large piece of artwork. When you're sitting there, it's like bigger than a magazine, right? And then experiencing it, reading, enjoying the creativity that these album covers and the insides kind of did. I mean, I don't know if you remember there was one that I saw, I think it's still hilarious, the Cheech and Chong album. They had a giant zigzag in the
Bamboo. Yeah, we used to listen to that in summer camp. I this guy used to bring it. We had that on cassette. That was actually Sister Mary Frances Elephant, I think, is like the famous bit that's on there, one of them. Hey, you know, man, I had a lot of cassettes growing up, and it was like when we're younger or these times that we live through, it's the way that we ingest it, having the dual tape deck. How many boom boxes did I have? You know, man, I feel blessed to have this turntable in this system here. Are you kidding me? Oh, man, and not to mention making tapes for your friends and your buddies. Those dual-to-dual cassettes, man. It was, remember, big deal to have auto-reverse.
Oh, yeah.
Come on, baby. You know.
I just remember the first time I saw a CD player skip a song, because if you think about it, at least a record, you can, like, go forward fast.
Yeah.
Oh, we used to labor over, like, oh, where is it? And you had to, like, stop it and guess. And when I saw a CD skip right to the next song, dude, it was, like, the craziest thing I ever saw in my whole life up until that point.
It's amazing. I still remember when I was getting CDs. Yeah, that was a luxury. Yeah. What? I could just go right to that tune and just hit a button and hear it over and over again. It was great.
Yeah, just to be able to work out with a CD. I mean, the Walkman was big. And for me, the first thing we ever had was like this FM radio player. Mm. And I was just like, oh, man, this is like so cool. And then the Walkman. But then when the CD came, it's like you wanted to run with it, but that thing skipped all the time. Now it's like everything technology-wise has come to this consumption that's very personal and exactly what you want when you want it. And in a way, a little bit has been lost, I think, in the experience. I mean, there's a little bit of a labor of love involved in watching and listening to a record. And you got to get the needle on there. And there's a lot that can not go wrong, but a lot that needs attention in the whole process.
Sure.
And I think that's part of the love, is this process that you go through where you sit and you read and you consume, and it's your focus. You can't be distracted while you're doing it. You definitely cannot walk down the street doing it. You can definitely listen on headphones or loudspeakers, but like, it's all there, and it's like this journey that you take with the musician in a way, and you see what they wanted you to see, and they hear hopefully exactly what you wanted them to hear. So I think there's that nostalgia, and that's, in my opinion at least, that the recent vinyl resurgence has to do with that kind of counterculture, teeny bite size thing that's being so pervasive through everything we do, and it's leaking into all media, TV replaced by YouTube, it's splintered. And people want to go back to that emotional connection. I think, in my mind at least, it's getting a little dry. If there was a specific year where you feel like the majority of the better music was made, in the sand. So it's just a one year answer. And on one side of that line, the majority of the best music was made. And then we have this up until this date on the other side. What year is that?
How about a whole decade? How about we just say the 1960s?
60s.
I think there was so much magic. And 60s and 70s are like a magic period for me, I think, in terms of what evolved, what occurred. You know, you really need to know where you've been to know where you're going. And I'm still trying to figure out what was done in those decades. And George, man, we are so right there, eye to eye. He feels the exact same thing. Music of the 60s and 70s was just something so special in terms of the artists. And, you know, it's still inspiring people. I still haven't heard all of it yet. Mm-hmm. I'm still going back and discovering things, although still discovering stuff that's in current times too. But, yeah, 60s and 70s to me were like this magic period in the history of music.
I feel like a lot during that time period as well, in terms of production, it was like it was new. These things were new, like recording was new.
Yep.
And you had like remedial recording, but like, you know, recording studios. And we started to capture something that for years and years had been only consumed live. And it was like a totally new thing. That's what I think is so inspirational during those time periods. And especially when, to put it into some mind, like rock as well. I mean, I've read articles that Jimi Hendrix, when he was playing, he was like designing his pedals. Like the sound that he made had not been heard really before. So like that freshness, that uniqueness, that, you know, first steps on the moon for music, I think had a lot to contribute to this powerhouse of creativity that just exploded for a couple of years.
There was really, I think, for artists themselves, like you said, talking about Hendrix, I think about Eric Clapton, like on Swabler, what do they call that, Woman Tone? Like all these like things that were going on, Brian Eno and his suitcase of electric gadgetry and how that maybe enhanced John Cale and a slew of other artists too. I mean, you know what? Explorations in music is a thing, man. And it's like, you know, we've learned by it from a lot of these guys, but I'm still trying to soak it all in. I still get the feels, man. Yeah. No, I mean, I do. I mean, those things still, they make me feel a certain way. Certain records that I like to listen to, you know, I keep coming back to. Well, there's a reason for that, because they make me feel a certain way. Or they, I don't know, I just love it.
Great, man. Is there anything specific that you'd like to plug at the end of the podcast?
Sure. Well, let me just tell you, I'm working on a whole bunch of different projects this year leading into 2018. First of all, I hope to have news soon. I'm actually in development right now of my own podcast, which will be centered around jazz music and different related subjects to jazz. So I hope to have more to talk about soon. I'm also working on a variety of different releases, which are on different ends of the spectrum. I've got two different Grant Green projects of previously unissued recordings from 1969 and 70 and 1975. Two different albums are going to come out later this year for Record Store Day, so be on the lookout for that, and then the CD and digital version will come out later. I'm also working on a special project of previously unissued Eric Dolphy recordings, which I'm working on with the great flautist and composer and multi-instrumentalist, I should say, the great James Newton. And we are working on that release, which will come out later this year in November, it looks like. Also working on a collection of Cannonball Adderley music from 1967 of never-before-issued extremely good live recordings, which bottle up the Cannonball Adderley experience of what you would have witnessed during those periods. He was an incredible performer, as was his entire working band with his brother Nat, Joe Zobinel, Victor Gaskin, Roy McCurdy in this case. And that's going to come out on the Cellar Live label out of Vancouver. My good friend Mr. Corey Weeds and I are putting that together. I am also on another end of things working on 5 reissues of classic Temptations albums that were all produced by the great Norman Whitfield. Those will be out in early 2018. They are going to be like little retro mini LPs or CDs, but they're going to have the complete unedited versions of these tracks that are basically being reissued in this state for the very first time. But Norman Whitfield was one of the great visionaries at Motown, and these are the records he produced. So I'm really excited about that. I'm also working with my good friend Ricky Riccardi and Harry Weinger at Universal Music Group to put out a new collection of Slim Gaylard music, which also contains some tracks that have never been issued before. And that's going to come for the very first time. That's very exciting. And a bunch of other projects, too. I mean, it's never every... Man, no boring moments around here. I tell you, I'm just really blessed. I don't want to screw anything up. And I would encourage anyone listening to reach out to me on Facebook. I have an active account there, which I use as basically a forum to post about the projects that I'm involved with, including even special events like today with you. So follow me there or befriend me there. Send me a friend request or drop me a line. I always love to hear from people. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Sure.